Please the court. My name is Marshall Ellis and I represent the appellant in this matter, Lanier Moses. The issue in this case is whether section 1B1.3's application note 5C is controlling and entitled to our deference after the Supreme Court's 2019 decision in Kaiser versus Wilkie. Here, the district court specifically relied upon application note 5C to count as a prior conviction for a controlled substance offense under the career offender guideline a 2013 North Carolina.
Let me get the structure here so we're talking about the same thing.
Yes, sir.
We have a 2013 offense for which Mr. Moses was convicted and sentenced and served time. And then we have a 2018 offense of similar kind, which is at hand here. And your argument is that the two offenses are that the 13 offense is relevant conduct for the current offense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And even though the interruption is there.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because I don't believe that the interruption is necessarily dispositive under the guidelines framework that were offered in 1B1.3A2. And that's
so under your theory, we'd go back, we could get a 2011 drug distribution count, I know 2006, and counted all as relevant conduct instead of prior offenses, even though he is sentenced and convicted for the prior conduct, which I suppose is a conviction, counts as a conviction, doesn't it?
Well, it's a conviction, but just because it's a conviction, that doesn't mean it counts as criminal history. Criminal history is all.
Oh, no, I'm talking about relevant conduct, not criminal history.
Right. So I essentially saying the conviction itself is not what carries the day in the analysis. It's the conduct underlying the conviction, which 1B1.3A2 is looking at. And that's why
anything that's relevant conduct cannot be considered a conviction under your argument.
Anything that's relevant conduct. Well, my argument is that the conviction does not necessarily matter. It's about.
Well, right. You're saying this was counted. This 2013 conviction was counted. In order to enhance a sentence, and it was counted as a conviction.
Your argument
is that it should not be counted because the conduct underlying that conviction was relevant conduct to the current conviction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. Essentially, the district court in this case made that decision that it is criminal history rather than relevant conduct, solely relying upon application note 5C. And because of the Supreme Court's 2019 decision in Kaiser, that particular application note is not entitled to our deference, and the district court was wrong to rely upon that particular application note. So
you agree that if we apply the guidelines and the commentary, then your argument is foreclosed because 5C, right?
That's correct. If 5C okay. is going here, I lose. I would not deny that, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
All right. So you want us to overlook 5C, which explains how to do relevant conduct.
I want this court to not give it our deference. And I essentially am saying that particular application note is not interpreting the terms.
So in Stinson, the Supreme Court said that the guidelines, the policy statements and the commentary are all have the force of law. And the only time that we look away from the commentary is when it's inconsistent with the guideline in the sense that both cannot be enforced. That's what Stinson said.
That's true as to what Stinson
said. And so you're saying Kaiser overruled Stinson.
I think Kaiser says what Stinson meant to say all along.
Well,
that's what
except in Stinson, you remember the court spent a lot of time talking about the nature of the guidelines. The commission did the commentary to explain the policy statements, and they gave them all the force of law. And they didn't talk about ambiguities. They talked about inconsistency, and they gave that a narrow interpretation because of the nature of the commission and the guidelines. And while it's analogous to an agency, they did not require there be an ambiguity in the guideline in order to apply the commentary. If that were so, we would not be able to apply the commentary in most of our guideline applications because the guidelines are almost always ambiguous. The commentary explains them and talks about how they're to be applied. The question is, I know you rely on Kaiser, and Kaiser gives you a lot of help in the agency context, but the question is, Kaiser didn't purport to overrule Stinson, did it?
Kaiser did not overrule Stinson. Again, I think Kaiser essentially is saying what Stinson meant to say all along. So,
they misspoke in Stinson.
I'm not saying they necessarily misspoke. I'm saying they didn't quite say everything they meant to say as to that particular issue in that case.
They said a lot.
So, right.
They discussed the relationship between the commentary and the guidelines at length. They explained the nature, the force it was carrying, the policy statements. They had an earlier opinion that said policy statements carry the force of law.
I
understand your position. Yeah.
Yes, sir. And essentially, that is my position, is that Kaiser is changing the analysis that Stinson once gave us with respect to guidelines commentary.
Mr. Ellison, let me ask you this. Let's set aside 5C. All right. Let's take it out of the analysis. You don't want us to consider that. You consider that just an arbitrary rule. Otherwise, Mr. Moses' 2013, under your argument, is going to count as relevant conduct under 1B1.13A2. Okay. And I think you make two arguments. First thing you say is, well, the government waived any argument that there's no evidence that the 2013 and the 2018 are part of the same common scheme or plan or same course of conduct because they didn't raise that at sentencing. And then the corollary to that is you say, we can look at this PSR and conclude that the 2013 and the 2018 are part of a common scheme or plan or the same course of conduct. I've looked hard at this PSR and I'm having a hard time finding evidence that's undisputed that would satisfy either one of those, whether common scheme or plan or same course of conduct. If you're talking about same course of conduct, single episode, spree, regularity, you've got 5 years in 1 month between the 2013 and the 2018. So I don't think that fits. I think you're arguing common scheme or plan. And you make this argument, well, all of these distributions occurred in this Bragg Street neighborhood. That's not in the PSR. All we know is that he dealt a small amount of crack in 2013 in Raleigh and Wake County, and he did the same in 2018. You also ask us to infer that, he did these things in order to support himself. He's a low-level drug distributor, and that's what we should infer. Why should we infer that? I mean, the PSR also says he's a member of the Nine Trey Bloods. I mean, how do we know that in 2013 he wasn't dealing for the gang and then 2018 he was supporting himself? So point me to specific evidence in the PSR that supports your argument, set aside 5C, that you have satisfied that.
I understand the court's concern completely. And essentially what I think I've done here is possibly made a mistake in my briefs and even arguing that, because I think what we're getting at right now is a task that's best left to the district court to make factual findings and conduct the appropriate legal analysis under 1B1.3A2 and then application note 5B. That's not a task for this court to do, and I was wrong in my opinion to even suggest that it was in my briefs. So I think we're getting ahead of ourselves with your question as to what specific factors there are in the PSR that support same course of conduct or common scheme or plan. I think that's
okay. So you're conceding that there isn't sufficient evidence. We can't reach that. You have established that if we rule in your favor on the 5C, it has to go back.
I'm saying it has to go back for further factual findings by the district court as to that particular question you were asking.
Well, let me ask you this. This is a little puzzling to me what you're asking. The pre-sentence report lists a conviction in 2013. He served 3.5 years. He got sentenced and had a conviction. So now he's no longer distributing drugs while he's in prison. The court counted that conviction as a predicate offense for career offender, as the career offender statute allows any prior conviction that's a drug type, and you're saying we shouldn't count it. And then you're saying, but we have a question of fact. We should send it back to decide whether it's a common scheme.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is exactly what I'm asking you to do.
Why isn't it a prior conviction and satisfies the career offender enhancement?
It's not. Well, I think that would be something that's left to the district court to determine based on.
Except the pre-sentence report pointed out there was a conviction, there was a sentence, and he served the time.
That's right.
And so we have, under the definitions of the enhancement, which is career offender enhancement, we have a prior conviction, don't we? There's no question we have a prior conviction.
I would disagree because, again, when you're looking at what is a prior
conviction. That's not a conviction?
I'm not saying it's not a conviction. I'm saying
well,
it's
not. Well, that's what the enhancement requires. In other
yes,
words,
sir.
We don't even need to get under the other stuff. We just go to the career offender enhancement and say, does it satisfy the face of that enhancement?
So when you look at the career
4B1.1.
Yes, sir. And then 4B1.2 tells you what is a prior sentence of imprisonment for purposes of 4B1.1. 4B1.2 says that a prior sentence of imprisonment has to do with calculating sentences based on Chapter 4A of the guidelines. And that's where the 1B1.3A2 comes into play and with respect to my argument, because it's not necessarily the conviction itself that matters. It's whether it's a prior sentence under Chapter 4B1.2. Section 4A1.2, Your Honor.
And you don't think it's a prior sentence?
I do not think it's a prior sentence.
What was he doing in jail?
Your Honor, I don't think that
he spent 3.5 years in jail.
The time in jail is not dispositive. And I think there was an 11th Circuit case that I cited in my brief that specifically referenced that said that even though the defendant had served time in jail in between two separate acts that actually involved two different modus operandis, they were still relevant conduct to each other, even though he had spent time in jail. So that's what I'm getting at.
When the court convicts somebody and imposes a sentence and he serves time, we don't call it a conviction and sentence.
I'm not saying you don't call it a conviction and sentence. I'm saying it's not necessarily a prior sentence of imprisonment under Section 4A1.2 of the guidelines.
All right.
Yes, sir. And I think this all gets back to the significance of application of 5C. So in other words, you can be looking at conduct underlying two different offenses and trying to assess whether they're relevant to each other under 1B1.3A2. And you can go through the analysis under application of 5B and determine that they are related, because 5B is sort of the classic interpretive guideline commentary that's giving you specific factors to consider, specific definitions of what the terms mean. It's not dictating a result. It's just telling you how to apply the guideline. So you can come to one result under 5B, only to then keep reading right beneath it and get to 5C and be required to completely reverse the decision that you just reached under 5B. And that's essentially what I'm getting at here, Your Honor.
And your argument, Mr. Ellis, there would be whether it's our or Stinson, and even under Stinson, it's inconsistent with, because it essentially draws an arbitrary line. Let me ask you this. You cite three cases, the Shell case, Havis, and Riccardi. All right. And these are cases where the Sixth Circuit, in one case, the Fourth Circuit, in Riccardi, they applied our deference. The others are Stinson cases. But all of those cases held that the commentary was inconsistent and the guideline provision couldn't bear the weight of the commentary. So the commentary goes. But aren't those cases different in that in Shell, they were adding to the definition of a crime of violence, forcible sex offense, and Havis, adding an attempt definition to a controlled substance offense. Riccardi, it was essentially setting an arbitrary loss amount for use of access device at $500, regardless of how much the loss actually was. As I understand the court's concern in those cases, it was that the commentary was broadening the scope of the guideline to sweep in more potential criminal conduct, whereas here it's restrictive, right? And arguably it's protective to everyone but career offenders, granted. So respond to that. These cases are different, and does the fact that it's restricted matter and undermine your argument?
I totally agree that they are a little bit of a different nuance to the issue, but at the end of the day, they're all involving the same problem. So in Havis and all the other inchoate offense cases, you have essentially the guideline setting a general standard. That is, what does the term controlled substance offense means? In Riccardi, you have the same thing happening, except it's not saying what the term controlled substance offense means. It's saying what the term loss means. In this case, you have the guideline itself saying that when calculating the offense level, consider all other acts that were part of the same course of conduct or a common scheme or plan as the offense of conviction. And then in this case, as well as in the others, you have the problematic commentary in each case changing the outcome that you would have reached if you were left with that text alone and other interpretive commentary. So that's what I think the issue is here, is that the problematic commentary is changing the outcome.
But wouldn't common sense say that if somebody was dealing drugs in a neighborhood and got convicted and sentenced and was removed from the neighborhood for 3 years and then came back to the neighborhood and did it again, would you call that the same course of conduct under any kind of common sense?
I think you could, Your Honor, if the other evidentiary factors were there, like whether it was part of the same or whether it involved the same area, whether it involved the same drug.
Yeah, he did the same stuff. He knows the area. He did the same stuff. But why isn't it another conviction? In other words, why isn't it a new conduct that's, again, violating the law in the same way? Okay, but I understand what you're arguing. Why don't we hear from Mr. Bragdon?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Bragdon, and I represent the United States. I'd like to start by taking issue with one factual thing that the defendant said, and that is, I think the court did not specifically rely on commentary 5C. And so the court's judgment is at page 111. And it appears to be a factual determination by the court that even if this is the same general area that drugs is being sold, it's not part of the course of conduct. And so I think the court can rule in our favor for either of two reasons, either because it finds that commentary note 5C is valid, or because it finds that regardless of that, this is not the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan. I do think that, with respect to note 5C, I understand the defendant's argument to be that if this is relevant conduct, then under the various application notes under Chapter 4, that means it can't also be a conviction that counts. So it's got to be one or the other. It's either got to be relevant conduct or a counting conviction. We don't disagree with that. And so then the question is, well, is Application Note 5C a correct interpretation of what this means? And this is an application note that's been around for about 30 years. In November, it'll be 30 years. It's never been questioned or thrown out by any court. And I think it does conduct a very reasonable balance as to where to draw the line of what counts, because the whole purpose of this application note is to prevent double counting of conduct the defendant was previously convicted and sentenced on. And so if this application note is thrown out, a defendant could get a conviction, get sentenced for that, maybe for a very long sentence. He could then be convicted again, and that conduct that he already received a sentence for could serve as the basis for a higher guideline range. And while that might help this defendant and some career offender defendants, in general, that's a rule that's not going to be helpful or fair to most defendants.
And I think Mr. Bragdon, Mr. Ellis makes the argument that may be all fine and well as a matter of policy, but shouldn't that then be part of the guideline itself? In other words, it serves an important purpose, and I take your point. But what about that, right? Should be part of the normal course of notice and comment. If you want to do that, do it the right way.
So then I think we have to ask the question of, well, is that a reasonable interpretation of the guideline, or is it something that's inconsistent with it? And I do not think that rule is inconsistent with the language. And if we focus on course of conduct, common scheme or plan, these are broad, ambiguous words. And so when we start asking, well, can a conviction you've already been sentenced on be part of the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan, I think the general answer I would think of to that is no. A conviction you've already been sentenced on seems like it wouldn't be part of the same course of conduct or common scheme or plan.
And maybe Mr. Moses isn't a good test case, right? And I think Mr. Ellis might concede that he might not. But can't you envision a scenario where, you know, somebody's in a conspiracy, there's a state conviction, he's in jail for one day, he gets out, and he's right back in doing the same things in the same area with the same accomplices?
Yes. So maybe that does present a closer case. And I know that the government has taken the position in the past for instance, conduct that proceed, you know, if there's a conviction in the middle, say, you know, the defendant is, part of some illegal conspiracy, he gets convicted, and then he continues the illegal conspiracy, but the conviction and the sentence is for something different. We sometimes take the position of, well, you may have gone to jail for 30 days or 60 days, but this is still one scheme overall. But I think that still begs the question of, does that specific conviction that you've gotten a sentence for, is that going to be counted? And I think the fact that you've received, that the defendant has received a sentence for that, does separate it in a way that maybe just a short stint in jail or a conviction with a suspended sentence doesn't. And I think that both Kaiser and Stinson allow agencies some degree of policy discretion. They know that the agency understands the regulation better. They know that they understand the purposes and the reasons behind it better. And so the agency then gets to say, well, this is going to be much more logically in line with the purpose and the basis of the rule. And so when you have an ambiguous rule like you do here, and you have an interpretation of that fits very well within the purpose of the rule, I think this court should give that discretion unless it's inconsistent. And I don't see it as being inconsistent. So I think that's a lot of our argument. I think I will say just a couple more things on the 5C rule. This court multiple times has applied that rule. It's been in unpublished decisions. The Second Circuit, in a published decision, applied the rule and kind of explained the purpose behind it. No court has struck down or questioned the validity of 5C. And it also fits with this general idea. I think we put in the language of we put in there one of the purpose when they were thinking about this rule, they were thinking about it as being similar to the joinder provision where you join, you know, counts in one indictment. And again, that presumes the idea, well, you're not going to join a count in an indictment if there's already been a conviction for it. And that's a little bit of legislative history because it's something that the one of the authors of the sentencing guidelines put in an article. It's not part of the guidelines itself. But I think when we look at the guidelines as a whole, this fits very neatly with the structure. There's a rigid separation between relevant conduct, what's counting for the offense, and on the other hand, the criminal history. And the defendant's throwing out of this rule would merge those things together. And so I think that's what we would say. I do not think I need to add anything else as far as our arguments on the merits as to why this is not course of conduct or common scheme or plan. But I'll answer any questions the court has. Otherwise, I'll rest on our briefs.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bracton. Mr. Ellis, you have some rebuttal.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. And thank you, Mr. Bracton. As far as the contention here that the district court did not specifically rely upon application of 5C, I think that's wrong. Mr. Bracton pointed you out to page 111, but you have to read page 111 of the joint appendix, in conjunction with what came before it. And that's where on page 104, the district court specifically asked me at sentencing, so you're saying I should disregard application note 5C? And I, of course, said yes. She then said, let me go to the government now. Do you agree I should ignore footnote 5C? So when you read that in conjunction with page 111, I think it's really clear here that 5C is the underpinning of the district court's decision. And it's that which ultimately led her to overrule my objection and to sentence Mr. Moses as a career offender. Moving on then to the government's claim that 5C, again, I've heard multiple times that they're saying that 5C is an interpretation of the language of 1B1.3A2, and I just think that's not correct. I think 5C is not an interpretation. 5C is essentially a legislative policy rule on the part of the Sentencing Commission. And they are, you know, the hidden thing here is the Sentencing Commission, I'm not saying they're not free to make this rule. They just have to do it through the notice and comment rulemaking process by including this rule in the actual guideline text itself and not the commentary.
Well, it went through the whole notice and commentary, didn't it? I mean, the whole process was put together as a package, and I don't know if you'd call it an agency. Their role is analogous to an agency, but they really are a strange body in our constitutional structure. I mean, here you have Congress committing to this commission a broad range of authority under 994H, and this body created of federal judges coming creating this body of law, and they created it as a package. So it wasn't it was structured in such a fashion that they would give you the general rule and then they give you the explanation, and they would also distinguish between the general rule and a policy statement. And so that's what Stinson tried to address. I think, and Kaiser, of course, is not even in the guidelines context. It's in a different one, but it did address our deference, as you pointed out.
Right, and yeah. The Kaiser opinion does make mention of Stinson.
Yeah, they have it in a list. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, I think that's a good segue then to let's get right to the issue here as far as step 1 through 3. And the text here, we all agree, is same course of conduct, common scheme or plan. That's the guideline text we're looking at. We have to first ask whether that's ambiguous or not. It sounds like we're both agreeing that it is ambiguous. If it's ambiguous, we can then look to the commentary for potential guidance, not automatic guidance, but potential guidance. And that last part is where we're disagreeing here. We are saying that application note 5C is not a reasonable interpretation of 1B1.3A2. We're saying it's essentially a legislative rule that's effectively just an exception to the general rule, much the same as it was in Riccardi with respect to the gift cards. That was, the loss amount for the gift cards. In Riccardi, it was, you know, the guideline or the application note for 2B1.1 tells you what loss means and how it's the greater of actual or intended loss. And then it gets all the way to part F of that particular application note where it says special rules. That's essentially the same thing we've got here. And that's why we'd ultimately be asking the court to do exactly what Riccardi did and say that 5C cannot receive our deference. I did want to briefly address the government's essentially argument that what drastic effect is this going to have for other defendants? I think it's wrong to do that, because these should always be case-by-case determinations. It obviously helps Mr. Moses here. And to the concern that it might hurt a potential defendant in the future, let's remember that the guidelines do give defendants the potential to get credit towards their federal sentence for any sentences imposed that were part of the relevant conduct in this case. And that specifically comes from guideline sections 5G1.3 and 5K2.23. I don't want the court to lose track of that the guidelines do account for giving defendants credit for sentences that have already been served that are related conduct. And as to the potential effect here the claim that Moses isn't a good test case, I would not concede that. I just think we don't have enough of a record here from the district court to definitively say that right now. And again, she made her decision based on application note 5C. And we're asking for this case to be remanded with specific instructions to make further findings without reliance on 5C. And I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ellis. I know you're court appointed. I'd like to recognize your service and our appreciation for your service. You did a fine job. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting point, and you obviously have explored it at some depth. We also welcome again Mr. Bragdon and his argument. We normally would come down and shake your hands. We're going to have to use this greeting and our appreciation for your arguments as a substitute. But I know we'll see you both many times, hence, as long as this pandemic gets under control. Somebody needs to help us there. But thanks a lot, and have a good day. We'll adjourn court till this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.